tossing it into the corridor like a frisbee. The ceiling cracks, and boulders fall, and I use telekinesis to shield Sam and me from being crushed. Before I can say a word, the boy emerges clapping the dust off his hands. He's taller than I am, shirtless, and muscular. Sam steps forward, and to my surprise, he aims his gun at the boy's head.
"Just tell me, do you know my dad, Malcolm Good? Please!"
The boy looks past Sam and his weapon, focusing on the chests under my arms. That's when I notice the three scars on his leg. They're just like mine. He's one of us. I drop the other chest to the ground in shock. "What number are you?"
"I'm 4.
He squints at me and then offers his hand.
"I'm 9. Good job staying alive, number 4.
He reaches for the chest I've dropped. Sam lowers his gun, retreating down the corridor, stopping every few seconds to look inside a cell. 9 places his hand on the chest's lock, and it instantly shakes and snaps open. A yellow glow lights up his face when he opens the lid.
"Hell yeah!"
he laughs, placing a hand inside. 9 pulls out a tiny red rock and shows it to me.
"You have one of these?"
"I don't know. Maybe." I'm embarrassed by how little I understand the items in my own chest. 9 places the rock between his knuckles and aims his fist at the nearest wall. A white cone of light appears, and instantly we can see through the wall and into an empty jail cell. Sam runs in our direction.
"Wait, you have X-ray vision?"
"What number is the nerd?"
9 asks me, digging around in his chest again. "That's Sam. He's not Lorik, but he's our ally. He's looking for his dad." He tosses Sam the red rock.
"This will make shit go faster, Sammy. Just aim and squeeze."
"He's human, dude," I say. "He can't use this stuff." 9 places his thumb on Sam's forehead. Sam's hair blows upward, and I can smell electricity in the air. Sam stumbles backwards.
"Whoa!"
9 ducks his hands back into his chest.
"You've got about 10 minutes. Get to it."
I'm amazed that 9 has the ability to transfer powers to humans. Sam runs down the corridor, inspecting cells with a flick of the wrist. When he gets to the large metal door at the end, he aims the rock at it, exposing more than a dozen armed Moogs on the other side. And 1 is twisting together exposed wires in an open keypad.
"Sam!"
I yell, picking up my gun.
"Get back!"
Whoosh! The door rises, and the Moogs rush forward. Sam sprints away, firing over his shoulder.
"You have any other legacies yet?"
I ask 9 over the sound of my gun. He winks, and then he's gone, running along the cracked ceiling at super speed. The Moogs don't notice 9 until he's dropped behind them, and by then, it's too late. He's a tornado, ripping through them with a ferocity I didn't know Lorik possessed. Even 6 would be impressed. Sam and I stop firing, letting 9 dismember each Moog with his bare hands. When he's finished, 9 runs back along the left wall of the corridor before circling to the ceiling and then to the right wall, a cloud of ash trailing him.
"Anti-gravity," Sam says. "Now that's a cool legacy."
9 skids to a stop in front of his chest and kicks it shut.
"I can also hear pretty well, for miles."
"Okay, let's go," I say, scooping up my chest. 9 easily places his on his huge shoulder and grabs a gun from the floor.
"What about those other cells?"
he asks Sam, pointing down the corridor. 100 or more cell doors line the walls past where the Moogs had entered. "We have to go," I say, knowing we're already pushing our luck. It's only a matter of seconds before we'll be surrounded, but there's no persuading Sam. He runs under the large door, still holding the red rock. Another dozen Moogs suddenly emerge from a hidden tunnel entrance between us. Sam braces himself against the wall and fires. I see a few of the Moogs burst into ash. but then my view is blocked by a swarm of drooling crawls. Focusing my thoughts on a boulder, I whip it at the crawls, smashing all but a few. Nine catches a crawl by its back legs and slams the beast against the wall. He crushes another two, and when he's done, he turns to me, laughing. I'm about to ask him what's so funny when he launches a boulder right at me. I barely jump out of the way, and a moment later, my back is covered with black ash.
They're everywhere, he laughs.
We have to get to Sam. I try to run past Nine when an enormous pike in hand snatches us both.
Sam! I yell. Sam!
Sam doesn't hear us over the sound of his gun. The piken pulls us in the other direction, and in what feels like slow motion, I lose sight of my best friend. Before I can yell again, the piken throws us down the opposite tunnel. I hit the wall and land on one chest, and the other lands on top of me. The wind is knocked out of me, and when I look up, I see Nine spitting blood out. He's grinning.
Are you crazy? I ask. You're enjoying this? I've been locked up for over a year. This is the best day of my life!
Two pikens duck into the tunnel, blocking our direct path back to Sam. Nine wipes the blood from his chin and opens his chest. He pulls out a short silver pipe, and it expands violently at both ends until it's over 6 feet long and glowing red. He runs toward the pikens with the pipe over his head. I stand to join him, but feel a jolt of pain in my ribs. I dig inside my chest for my healing stone, but by the time I find it, Nine has killed both pikens. Running back along the ceiling, he twirls the pipe at his side, and when he's 20 feet away, he yells for me to move. The glowing red pipe sails over my head like a javelin, impaling a piken in the stomach.
Don't mention it,
Nine says before I can utter a word. More pikens squeeze into the far end of the tunnel, and when I turn around to run, a flock of transparent birds with razor-sharp teeth is flying towards us. Nine grabs a strand of green stones from his chest and flings it towards the flock. It hovers in the air and, like a black hole, sucks the birds into it. He closes his eyes, and the stones zip towards the pikens, spinning and unleashing the flock of birds into their faces. Nine points at me and yells,
"Boulder them!"
I follow his lead, rocketing boulder after boulder at the mayhem. The pikens and the birds collapse under our barrage. Several more pikens push their way into the tunnel, roaring. I grab Nine's arm to keep him from charging.
"They're just going to keep coming," I say. "We have to find Sam and get out of here. Number 6 is meeting us."
He nods, and we run. At the next opening, we veer left, unsure if we're making progress or getting even more lost. More and more enemies appear behind us with every new turn. Nine trashes every tunnel we pass through, bringing down ceilings and collapsing walls with telekinesis and perfectly thrown boulders. We come to a long, low, arching bridge of solid rock, similar to the one Sam and I shuffled along earlier, and below is a steaming pool of green lava. Charging across the other side of the narrow bridge is a thick line of Moogs, and behind us, several pikens are racing down the tunnel, straight towards us.
"Where do we go?"
I shout as we step onto the bridge. Nine says,
"We go under!"
Nine grabs my hand as we reach the peak of the bridge, and my world literally flips upside down into a running along the underside of the arch. Without warning, Nine lets go of me, but my shoes still firmly grip the belly of the bridge somehow. I reach over my head and scoop up a pile of the green lava, and by the time we're standing on the other side of the room, I have a perfect green ball of fire in my hand. I wing it at the Moogs on the bridge and visualize it spreading over them. I can hear the sizzling of their flesh when we duck into another cave. I'm out of breath when we reach a steep decline.
I'm judging the grade of the drop when I'm hit with a blast from behind. I topple forward and fall at an amazing speed. And when the ground finally levels out, my recently dislocated shoulder hits it first. I roll onto my stomach in unimaginable pain. The blast hit me square in the back, and my muscles are stuck in an uncontrollable spasm. I can hardly breathe, let alone search my chest for my healing stone. The only thing I can do is stare at the slivers of moonlight that appear and disappear at the end of the tunnel. The tarp. It's flapping in the forest wind. I'm back to where I started. I hear the sound of rocks crumbling behind me. I'm in more pain than I thought imaginable, and all I can think about is leaving the mountain. Straight ahead. It's the exit. We can regroup out there, I manage. If we can make it outside, then I can heal myself, hide our chests in the forest. And maybe BK can come back in with us now that we've destroyed the gas tanks. The four Moogs who guarded the entrance are gone, and Nine jumps out through the tarp and into the forest. I follow. The stench from the dead animal carcasses hits us fast, and we both gag as Nine jogs into a line of trees. I collapse against a trunk. I need 5 minutes, I think. Then we're going back in for Sam. Guns and hands blazing. Nine digs around his chest and I close my eyes. Tears roll down my face. I'm startled by something rough touching my left hand. I open my eyes to see it's Bernie Kosar in his beagle form, licking my fingers. I don't deserve that, I tell him. I'm a coward. I'm cursed. He notices my injuries and tears, and then sniffs Nine's face before expanding into a horse.
Whoa!
Nine jumps back.
What the hell are you?
Chimera, I whisper. He's a good guy. He's Lorik. Nine quickly pets BK's muzzle, and then presses a healing stone to my back. As it works through my system, I notice a menacing storm brewing over the mountain. The sky suddenly rages with lightning and booming thunder, and I'm so grateful Six has returned that I stand, ignoring the remaining pain in my back. The clouds shift and stretch in a way I've never seen before, though, and the sky feels suddenly evil. This isn't Six. She's not back to help. I watch the funnel cloud that I've only seen in my worst visions form. Bernie Kosar rears backward as a perfectly spherical spaceship, milky white like a pearl, sweeps down through the tornado's eye. The ship lands right in front of the mountain's entrance, sending tremors through the ground. In the same way as I had seen in my visions, a door appears from out of nowhere on the ship's side, simply melting away. The Mogadorian leader from my visions, he's here. Nine gasps.
Cetricus Ra! He's here! This is it.
I'm silent, frozen in fear. So that's his name, I finally whisper.
That was his name. For every day they tried to torture me and my Saipan, I'm going to stab him with this.
The red pipe glows in Nine's hand. Its ends expand with rotating blades.
I'm going to kill him, and you're going to help me.
Cetricus Ra walks towards the cave's entrance, but stops before going in. One massive silhouette, stark and spectral. Through the raging wind and torrential rain, he turns, lifting his gaze in our general direction. Even from as far away as I am, the faint glow of the three pendants is unmistakable around his thick neck. Nine and I charge out of the trees, with Bernie Kosar galloping behind, but it's too late. Cetricus Ra has disappeared into the cave, and the same bubbling blue force field that covered the prison cell doors appears over the entrance.
No!
Nine yells. He slides to a stop and stabs the ground with his pipe. With my dagger in my hand, I keep going. I hear Nine scream for me to stop, but all I can think about is killing Cetricus Ra, saving Sam and his dad, and ending this war right here, right now. When I hit the blue force field, everything goes black.
Chapter 32. Thunder rolls, followed by brilliant streaks of lightning. And in their glare, I see the clouds expand and drop. Rain falls in heavy sheets, and the armored Mogadorian looks down at me. He presses the cannon against my blue pendant and says something I can't understand. My wound in my stomach has almost healed, and I hear Ella yell my name over the thunder. If I'm going to die, then I need to release Ella first. One of us needs to live to tell the others. I cautiously lift my hands and envision the trunk separating when a bolt of lightning cracks in the distance. Less than a second later, the bolt strikes the Mogadorian standing over me, and he turns to ash and is swept away in the wind. I climb to my feet and see that I've opened the beech tree's trunk halfway. I continue to separate the tree as I run towards it. Ella! Are you okay? She spills out of the trunk and falls into my arms.
I couldn't see you, she says, squeezing me. I thought I'd lost you.
Not yet, I say, grabbing my chest. Come on. We turn to run and see Creighton and Hector coming towards us. Hector's been hurt, and his arm is over Creighton's shoulders for support. The wind and rain are raging. Behind them, the first wave of Mogadorians and Krolls are charging up the shore after them. When I see this, I break away a large limb from a dead tree and hurl it hard at the closest pack of Krolls. It knocks down several, but they're back up again in no time. A Mogadorian soldier throws a grenade that I intercept midair with my mind and send it right back into his stomach. It explodes, throwing several Mogadorians and Krolls to the ground in soggy bits of ash. I send tree after tree, rock after rock, knocking many to the ground, killing more.
Help me!
Creighton yells. I rush to take Hector from him. He has a bite wound in his stomach and a bullet hole in his arm, and both are bleeding badly.
Come on, everyone!
Creighton yells, pulling bullets from his coat pocket and quickly sliding them into his gun's empty clip.
We have to get to the dam!
I open my mouth to respond, but an enormous lightning bolt snaps over us. It spreads across the sky like the veins of the gods, leaving the distinct taste of metal in the air. A deafening clap of thunder reverberates off the mountains. The wind and rain cease, and the clouds rotate around and around in a massive maelstrom until a dark, glowing eye forms, staring at us from high over the mountaintops. The Mogadorians are just as mesmerized as we are. The wind kicks up again, and the dark clouds and the thunder and lightning come with it, slow at first, but quickly gaining speed, heading our way. A perfect storm, beautiful at its cataclysmic heart, unlike anything I've ever seen before. All any of us can do is watch the thick clouds rolling towards us with a deep growl.
What's happening?
I scream over the gale-force winds.
I don't know, Creighton replies. We're going to need to find some cover.
But he doesn't move, and neither does anyone else. Hector seems to have forgotten all about the pain of his wounds as he watches, too.
Go!
Creighton finally yells, and then he spins around and fires on the Mogadorians to cover us as we run over a slight hill and then down into a valley. I see the dam on my right, which connects two lower mountains. It's too far away to realistically believe we'll reach it. Hector's face has turned white, and he's fading fast, and I start looking for a place to rest so I can heal him. Creighton's gun falls silent. I look behind me, fearing the worst, but he's merely out of ammo. He chucks the gun over his shoulder and catches up to us.
"We're not going to make it to the dam," he yells. "Run to the lake!"
The rain starts up again as the four of us change direction. Bullets zip into our grassy footprints and ricochet off boulders. The clouds shift over us with a roar. A second later, it's as if we've gone under a bridge. The rain just stops. I look over my shoulder, and I see that just a few paces back, the rain still falls heavy and hard. The wind picks up significantly, and suddenly, the Mogadorians behind us are stuck in the worst rainstorm I've ever seen. They completely disappear in a blur. Our shoes slip over the sand on the shore, and Ella and Creighton dive into the water headfirst.
"I can't do it, Marina,"
Hector says, stopping before his feet reach the water. I drop my chest and grab his arm and say,
"I can fix you, Hector. You can make it."
"It wouldn't make any difference. I don't know how to swim."
"I'm Marina of the Sea, Hector, remember?"
I allow the iciness to spread from my fingertips to the bullet hole in his arm. I watch it turn from black and gray and red to a tan patch of wrinkled skin. I quickly concentrate on the bite wound on his stomach beneath his shirt, and Hector suddenly stands up straight with energy. I look into his eyes. "As the Queen of the Sea, I will swim with you."
"But you have that,"
Hector says, pointing at the chest.
"You'll have to hold it then,"
I say, dropping it into his arms. We jog into the water until our feet no longer touch the lake floor, and then I wrap my arm around Hector's chest and paddle with my left. Hector hugs the chest to his stomach, and he floats on his back, his head just above water. Ella and Creighton tread water in the middle of the lake, and I pull Hector towards them. The clouds overhead dissipate, shrinking into 100 wispy lines of gray in the sky. The advancing Mogadorians are no longer a blur in a rainstorm, and the moment they can see, they charge at the lake, with dozens of crawls yipping in front of them. A tiny black speck falls from above as the last cloud disappears, and the closer the speck gets, the more it appears to be a human. Wearing a large blue pendant around her neck, she lands on the shore, rippling the sand. It's a strikingly beautiful girl with raven-colored hair. And the second I see her, I know she's the one I've been dreaming of, the one I painted on the cave's wall.
"She's one of us," I shout.
The girl looks around. We make eye contact, and then she vanishes a moment later. I'm shocked, crushed, believing I must have imagined her.
"Where'd she go?" Ella asks.
The moment I realize Ella saw her too, that I hadn't imagined her, I watch as the two nearest crawls are somehow yanked backwards in the air. They're hovering, yipping and snarling at something behind them. And then they slam into each other until they fall limp. One crawl goes sailing into the legs of two soldiers, and the other is swung in the air, connecting with other crawls and soldiers.
"Invisibility. She has the legacy of invisibility," Creighton breathes.
"She's invisible?"
I'm amazed and jealous at the same time. But most of all, I'm grateful. Every crawl that touches the water is yanked backwards by an unseen hand and slammed into the hard sand, or a Mogadorian soldier. A dropped cannon rises from the grass and starts firing in all directions. Crawl after crawl is destroyed. Dozens of Mogadorians burst into clouds of ash. Cannon blasts come from the other side of the lake, and I spin to see 20 or more Mogadorians wading in up to their waists. Rays of light hit the water all around us, creating enough steam that I can barely see Hector in front of me.
Ella!
I shout.
Over here!
She yells from my left.
Take Hector!
She wraps her arm around Hector's chest.
Why?
Because I'm not going to stay out here while that girl fights all by herself. This is my war, too.
Before anyone can stop me, I sink below the surface, and the water instantly tickles my lungs. I swim deeper, until the green-blue color of the lake becomes gray. I see the hulking body of Olivia below me. She's lying lifeless on the lake floor, clouds of blood billowing from the hundreds of bite wounds on her back. I head towards the opposite shore, and after a minute, I can see the legs of the Mogadorians. I swim next to the one farthest on the left. I plant my feet in the muddy bottom and launch myself out of the water. The Mogadorian doesn't have enough time to react as I toss him towards the middle of the lake with my mind. I float his cannon into my hands, shoot him, and never let go of the trigger. The Mogadorians along the lake burst into ash, and when I've killed them all, I aim towards the hundreds near the vehicles. There's movement in the water behind me, and I'm too slow. A crawl jumps and sinks its teeth into my side. The pain is immediate and horrible, as if someone was holding a hot branding iron to my ribs. The beast whips me headfirst into the water, and then against the sand of the shore. I catch my breath and scream as it arcs me back over and into the water again. I'm sure this is how I will die, but suddenly, the crawl's mouth widens and releases me. I fall onto my stomach, on the shore, and watch as the crawl's mouth continues to widen until I hear bones snapping. The raven-haired girl materializes before my eyes, her hands on the beast's quivering lips. She looks back at me before yanking the jaws completely vertical, killing the crawl.
Are you okay? The girl asks me.
I lift up my shirt and place a hand on my wound. I will be in a second. She ducks a blast from a cannon.
Good. What number are you?
7.
I'm 6, she says before vanishing.
The iciness spreads from my fingers over my body, but I know I won't be able to heal myself completely before the oncoming wave of Mogadorian soldiers reaches me. I roll into the lake and stay underwater. My wound is almost healed when I rise above the surface. Number 6 is on top of one of the armored Humvees with a glowing sword. She's fighting several soldiers at once, hacking off body parts, blocking cannon fire with her blade, using telekinesis to aim a floating cannon high above her so it blasts through dozens of Mogadorians on the formation's edge. She then hurls her sword into a crowd, impaling 3 soldiers at once. Number 6 grabs the large gun mounted on top of the vehicle and mows down dozens of Mogadorians in seconds. There are only 20 or 30 soldiers left, maybe 4 crawls. Number 6 holds one hand over her head, while a gun in the other shoots and destroys the Humvees along the shore. Dark clouds form over the mountains, and bolts of lightning crack and split the ground near her. The Mogadorians show fear for the first time, and I watch a few drop their weapons and run towards the woods.
Out of the water!
I yell, fearful of the lightning. Ella drags Hector to the edge of the lake, and Creighton follows. I reach the shore near number 6 and pick up 2 cannons,
I struggle to keep my footing as I press both triggers, turning more soldiers to ash, destroying two of the crawls. An injured soldier hiding behind a wrecked Humvee tosses a grenade at number six's back, but I'm able to shoot it in the air. The explosion rotates number six and the mounted gun, and a moment later, the injured soldier is nothing but ash. I can't keep my eyes off of number six. Her strength is mesmerizing. The blue pendant bounces around as the gun in her one hand cuts down more and more soldiers. She rotates to her left and blows a crawl into bits, and then she rotates to her right and takes out several more Mogadorians with a bolt of lightning. The valley is bright and smoky. It's damp and charred. I look around me and can't believe that victory will be ours in just a matter of seconds. Creighton races over, and I toss him one of my guns, and instantly he's killing soldiers, retreating into the woods. Hector runs with my chest, and soon he and Ella stand behind me. I nod towards number six and smile at my friends, thinking that the worst is over. But that's when Ella raises her eyes over my head, and her face turns white.
"Pykins!"
Ella yells. Four of the horned monsters run down the mountainside at full speed. Directly below them, number six is preoccupied with a few remaining soldiers and the crawl. I uproot as many silver firs as I can and send them like rockets. Four hit the lead one, and it falls backwards into the path of the other three, and it's crushed and killed in the stampede.
"Number six!"
I shout. She hears me, and I point to the pikins rumbling down into the valley. She spins with a gun and blows the knees off the monster on the left. It tumbles down faster than the other two can run, and number six jumps from the Humvee a moment before the dead pikin flattens it with an echoing crunch. Creighton and I shoot our cannons at the other two, but they're too fast, splitting up when they reach the valley floor. The clouds roar when number six stands, and an enormous bolt of lightning crashes into one of the pikins, cutting off its arm. It bellows and falls to its knees, but quickly regains its balance and charges ahead with blood spurting from its side. The other pikin dodges Creighton's fire and rushes in from the other direction. We all run towards number six, but Hector is too slow with my chest in his arms. The pikin closes in, and before I can help, the one-armed monster reaches down and snatches Hector and my chest in its fist.
"No!"
I scream.
"Hector!"
I'm in such shock that when the pikin throws a lifeless Hector and my chest into the lake, I don't use my telekinesis to stop either from sinking. Number six has killed the other pikin. She turns towards us now and holds both hands up to the sky. A lightning bolt severs the monster's head from its body. For the first time all day, there is silence. I lean into number six, look at Ella and Creighton and the fire and destruction behind them, and I know that these quiet moments are about to become rare in my life.
"Your chest, Marina," Creighton says. "You have to go get it."
I turn to number six and hug her.
"Thank you. Thank you, number six."
"I'm sure we'll get a chance to do it again sometime."
She wraps her arms around my shoulders.
"And just call me Six."
"I'm Marina. This is Creighton and Ella. She's number 10.
Ella steps forward and shrinks to her 7-year-old body. She extends her small hand towards Six, who has her mouth open, speechless. Creighton starts to explain Ella and the second ship to Six as I walk into the lake. I feel its coolness for the first time. I swim to the middle and dive, descending until the water is devoid of any light and my feet touch the muddy floor. I circle the bottom until I see my chest. I rock it back and forth to dislodge it from the mud's suction. Swimming with one arm, I start to ascend. When the water turns blue, I see Hector's body and wrap my other arm around his waist. Ella and Creighton stand with Six on the shore. I drop the chest and slap my wet hands on Hector's shin, arm, neck, all around his crushed back, hoping and praying the icy feeling will arrive in my fingers.
"He's dead," Creighton says, pulling on my shoulders.
I don't give up, hating myself for not trying the same thing on Adelina. I touch Hector's face. I run my hands through his gray hair. I even levitate him a few centimeters off the sand and try it all over again. But it's true. He's gone.
Chapter 33. I'm hovering over grass. I'm floating over a river. I feel wretched and stiff, and every time I dare to open my eyes, I'm either bouncing over a log or gliding up a rocky hill. There's a constant noise, and it takes me several minutes to realize it's the sound of Bernie Kosar's hooves. I'm draped over his back, and we're moving quickly through the mountains.
"You awake?"
Nine asks. I raise my head to see him sitting behind me, both of our chests under his arms. "I don't know what I am," I say, closing my eyes.
What happened?" "You ran right into the blue stuff. That's the last thing on Earth or Lorien or anywhere you want to do."
He sounds pissed, like I just tore him away from his own birthday party.
"What about Cetricus Ra?" I ask. "Somewhere in the mountain, the coward. I couldn't find another way in, and I looked."
I push myself up BK's hide in a panic.
"Where's Sam?" "Not a chance for. Your buddy is either long gone, or he's hanging upside down staring at the wrong end of a knife."
I vomit. Bernie Kosar quickly lowers himself so I can slide off his back, and then I vomit some more. Nine tries to explain the sickness will go away soon, that he's gone through it several times when he tried to escape his cell, that the healing stone seems to be powerless against the force field's effects, but I'm too dizzy with visions of Sam being tortured to listen. My sickness is from my betrayal, not from some Mogadorian force field. I don't think I'll ever be able to forgive myself. It's my fault he went in there, and it's my fault he was left behind. I turn my back on my best friend.
"We have to go back," I say. "Sam would go back for me." "Not a chance. Not yet. You're too much of a mess, and like you said before, we need numbers."
I pull myself to my feet, but fall onto my hands and knees almost immediately.
"You don't even know where we are. We're a couple of miles from your car,"
Nine says. He must see the confusion on my face, because he smiles and pats Bernie Kosar's back.
"Turns out I can talk to animals. Who knew? Bernie Kosar here is leading the way. Let's jet."
I'm too weak to protest, and I climb back up. Bernie Kosar gallops as fast as he can, his belly brushing the tops of shrubs and felled trees as he hurdles us over obstacles. My body aches, and I clutch his side as we zigzag up and down the mountains and hills, splashing through two fast-moving rivers. The stars slowly reveal themselves, high in the sky, and I know that one of them, far, far away, is the slight glimmer of Lorien's own sun, shining its bright light upon a hibernating planet.
"So, what's our next move?"
Nine asks as we trot among the shadows. I'm silent, wondering what Henri would say our next move would be. I wonder what kind of look would be on his face. Would he beam with pride over me retrieving the chests, rescuing a member of the guard, and killing so many Moogs in the process? Or would he be disappointed in me for not taking on the leader when I had the chance, and for leaving Sam behind?
Visions of Sam locked behind one of those steel doors come to me every few seconds, and I watch my tears glide down BK's neck. I hate to think it, but I'd rather he die than be tortured for information about me. I try to blame Sarah for turning us into the police, but I can only blame myself for contacting her when everyone told me not to. I keep quiet and dig my heels into Bernie Kosar's hide, and he picks up the pace. Six is somewhere in Spain, hopefully with another member of the guard. Part of me wants to get on a plane to go directly to her, but with my escape from a federal facility and my face still on the FBI's most wanted list, I don't see how it's possible. We make it to the SUV, and I painfully dismount. I unlock the back door, and Nine quietly loads both chests into the trunk, crawling across the back seat, disgusted with myself. I ask Nine if he'll drive.
"I was hoping you'd ask,"
Nine replies. I hand him the keys and feel the engine come to life. Something is under my body, and I shift to my side to find Sam's dad's glasses. I hold them above my head, and I let the moon reflect in the lenses. I suck in a deep breath and whisper, "We'll see each other again soon, Sam. I promise." And then, when I think things can't get much worse, it hits me almost harder than the blue force field.
Oh, shit! Six's address for when we meet, it was in Sam's pocket. I'm so stupid! How are we gonna find each other now?
Over his shoulder, Nine says,
"Don't worry, Four. Things are happening for a reason. If we're supposed to meet up with Six or Five or whoever, we will. And if Sam is supposed to still be a part of all this, he will be."
Bernie Kosar jumps into the back seat in his beagle form and licks my cheek. I pat his head and let out a long-drawn sigh, an utter disbelief that after everything that's gone wrong in the last 48 hours, I've also managed to lose the address Six had written down. I look out the window to see the wind is blowing to the north, and I wonder if it might be telling me something, or at the very least, pointing me in the right direction, as Six believes it's done for her. "Head north," I say. "I think north would be good."
"You got it, boss."
Nine steps on the gas, and I look over at Bernie Kosar, who has curled up and fallen asleep.
We bury Hector's body at the bottom of the dam, where the white concrete meets the grass. "He once told me that the key to change is letting go of fear," I say, looking into the eyes of Ella, Creighton, and Six. "I don't know if I've let go of fear just yet, but the change is happening. It's definitely happening, and I can only hope that you all can help me through it."
"We're a team," Ella says. "Of course we will."
After we say our goodbyes, we climb the dam's ladder. We stand on top of the dam, peering down into the valley and the lake. On the other side of the dam is a series of locks holding back a much larger lake, and I can't help but think it's a metaphor for the way I'm feeling right now. In front of me lies my past, small and distant and dotted with carnage, threatened to be flooded at any time. Behind me and my fellow guard members, the future is massive and held back by unnatural forces. I turn to Six and ask,
"Do you know a John Smith in Ohio? Is he one of us?"
Her smile is wide. "I do know John. He's number Four." I reach for Ella's hand on my right and Six's on my left, and we stand there, letting the mountain breeze whip our hair around our faces. Ella looks over at Six and asks,
"Can we go to America?"
"The charm is broken. I don't see why we can't all be together now," Six shrugs, turning back to the lake below. Creighton joins us.
"I hate to say this, but it's the calm before the storm, ladies.
We're winning far too many battles for them to ease up now. You're getting too strong for them, and they'll be throwing everything they have at you. No more small armies with a few hundred soldiers and a couple of clumsy beasts. Their ruler will be here soon. Cetricus Ra.
Who?
I ask. Cetricus Ra. Creighton shakes his head, and I don't think we're ready for him.
Then it's settled, I say.
We're going to Ohio to be with John Smith.
West Virginia, actually. In exactly 2 weeks, Six says.
I'm not sure that's wise just yet. Creighton begins walking away. We need to gather the others first.
Six walks after him.
That sounds good and all, but I have no idea where they are.
I do, Creighton says, not turning around. I also know where our chimeras are. If Cetricus Ra thinks this is going to be easy, he's got another thing coming.
We follow him, taking the first of many steps down the opposite side of the dam.
And now, a sneak listen to the first chapter of the next book in the series. Enjoy!
Harper Audio presents The Rise of Nine, Book 3 of the Lorien Legacies by Pittacus Lore. Performed by Neil Kaplan, Marisol Ramirez, and Devin Sorvery.
The events in this book are real. Names and places have been changed to protect the Lorik, who remain in hiding. Other civilizations do exist. Some of them seek to destroy you.
Chapter 1 6A. Seriously? I look at the boarding pass in my hand, its large type announcing my seat assignment, and wonder if Creighton chose this seat on purpose. It could be a coincidence, but the way things have gone recently, I am not a big believer in coincidences. I wouldn't be surprised if Marina sat down behind me in row 7, and Ella made her way back to row 10. But no, the two girls dropped down beside me without saying a word, and joined me in studying each person boarding the plane. Being hunted, you are constantly on guard. Who knows when the Mogadorians might appear? Creighton will board last, after he's watched to see who else gets on the plane, and only once he feels the flight is absolutely secure. I raise the window shade and watch the ground crew hustle back and forth under the plane. The city of Barcelona is a faint outline in the distance. Marina's knee bounces furiously up and down next to mine. The battle against an army of Mogadorians yesterday at the lake, the death of her Sepon, finding her chest, and now, it's the first time in almost 11 years that she's left the town where she spent her childhood. She's nervous. Everything okay? I ask. My newly blonde hair falls into my face and startles me. I forgot I dyed it this morning. It's just one of many changes in the last 48 hours.
Everyone looks normal, Marina whispers, keeping her eyes on the crowded aisle. We're safe as far as I can tell.
Good, but that's not what I meant. I gently set my foot on hers, and she stops bouncing her knee. She offers me a quick apologetic smile before returning to her close watch of each boarding passenger. A few seconds later, her knee starts bouncing again. I just shake my head. I feel sorry for Marina. She was locked up in an isolated orphanage with a Sepon who refused to train her. Her Sepon had lost sight of why we are here on Earth in the first place. I'm doing my best to help her, to fill in the gaps. I can train her to learn how to control her strength and when to use her developing legacies. But first, I'm trying to show her that it's okay to trust me. The Mogadorians will pay for what they've done. For taking so many who we've loved, here on Earth and on Lorien. It's my personal mission to destroy every last one of them, and I'll be sure Marina gets her revenge, too. Not only did she just lose her best friend, Hector, back at the lake, but like me, her Sepan was killed right in front of her. We will both carry that with us forever.
How is it down there, Six? Ella asks, leaning over Marina.
I turn back towards the window. The men below the plane begin to clear away their equipment, conducting a few last-minute checks. So far, so good. My seat is directly over the wing, which is comforting to me. On more than one occasion, I've had to use my legacies to help a pilot out of a jam. Once, over southern Mexico, I used my telekinesis to push the plane a dozen degrees to the right only seconds before crashing into the side of a mountain. Last year, I got 124 passengers safely through a vicious thunderstorm over Kansas by surrounding the plane with an impervious cloud of cool air. We shot through the storm like a bullet through a balloon. When the ground crew moves on to the next plane, I follow Ella's gaze towards the front of the aisle. We're both impatient for Creighton to board. That will mean everything is okay, at least for now. Every seat is full but the one behind Ella. Where is he? I glance out at the wing again, scanning the area for anything out of the ordinary. I lean down and shove my backpack under my seat. It's practically empty, so it folds down easily. Creighton bought it for me at the airport. The three of us need to look like normal teenagers, he says, like high school students on a field trip. That's why there's a biology textbook on Ella's lap.
Six? Marina asks.
I hear her buckle and unbuckle her seatbelt nervously. Yeah, I respond.
You've flown before, right?
Marina is only a year older than I am, but with her solemn, thoughtful eyes and her new sophisticated haircut that falls just below her shoulders, she can easily pass for an adult. Right now, however, she bites her nails and pulls her knees up to her chest like a scared child. Yes, I say. It's not so bad. In fact, once you relax, it's kind of awesome. Sitting there on the plane, my thoughts turn in the direction of my own Sepan, Katerina. Not that I ever flew with her. But when I was 9 years old, we had a close call in a Cleveland alley with a Mogadorian that left us both shaken and covered in a thick layer of ash. Katerina moved us to Southern California after that. Our crumbling two-story bungalow was near the beach, practically in the shadow of Los Angeles International Airport. 100 planes roared overhead every hour, always interrupting Katerina's teaching, as well as the little free time I had to spend with my only friend, a skinny girl next door named Ashley. I lived under those airplanes for 7 months. They were my alarm clock in the morning, screaming directly over my bed as the sun rose. At night, they were ominous ghosts, telling me to stay awake, to be prepared to rip off my sheets and jump in the car in a matter of seconds. Since Katerina didn't let me stray far from the house, the airplanes were also the soundtrack of my afternoons. On one of those afternoons, as the vibrations from an enormous plane overhead shook the lemonade in our plastic cups, Ashley said,
"Me and my mom are going to visit my grandparents next month. I can't wait. Have you ever been on a plane?"
Ashley was always talking about all the places she went and things she did with her family. She knew Katerina and I stayed close to home, and she liked to brag.
"Not really," I said. "What do you mean, not really? You've either been on a plane or you haven't. Just admit it. You haven't."
I remember feeling my face burn with embarrassment. Her challenge hit its mark. I finally said, "No, I've never been on an airplane." I wanted to tell her I've been on something much bigger,
something much more impressive than a little airplane. I wanted her to know I came to Earth on a ship from another planet called Lorien, and the trip had covered more than 100 million miles. I didn't, though, because I knew I had to keep Lorien secret. Ashley laughed at me. Without saying goodbye, she left to wait for her dad to come home from work. "Why haven't we ever been on a plane?" I asked Katerina that night as she peered out the blinds of my bedroom window. "Six," she said, turning to me before correcting herself. "I mean, Veronica. It's too dangerous for us to travel by plane. We'd be trapped up there. You know what could happen if we were thousands of miles in the air and then found out Moogs had followed us on board?" I knew exactly what could happen. I could picture the chaos, the other passengers screaming and ducking under their seats as a couple of huge alien soldiers barreled down the aisle with swords. But that didn't stop me from wanting to do something so normal, so human, as to fly on a plane from one city to the next. I'd spent all my time on Earth unable to do the things other kids my age took for granted. We rarely stayed in one place long enough for me to meet other kids, let alone make friends. Ashley was the first girl Katerina had ever allowed over to our house. Sometimes, like in California, I didn't even attend school if Katerina thought it was safer. I knew why all this was necessary, of course. Usually, I didn't let it bother me. But Katerina could tell that Ashley's superior attitude had gotten under my skin. My silence the following days must have cut through her, because to my surprise, she bought us 2 round-trip airline tickets to Denver. The destination didn't matter. She knew I just wanted the experience. I couldn't wait to tell Ashley. But on the day of the trip, standing outside the airport, Katerina hesitated. She seemed nervous. She ran her hand through her short black hair. She had dyed and cut it the night before, just before making herself a new ID. A family of 5 walked around us on the curb, dragging heavy luggage, and to my left, a tearful mother said goodbye to her 2 young daughters. I wanted nothing more than to join in, to be a part of this everyday scene. Katerina watched everyone around us while I fidgeted impatiently by her side. "No," Katerina finally said. "We're not going. I'm sorry, Veronica, but it's not worth it." We drove home in silence, letting the screaming engines of the planes passing overhead speak for us. When we got out of the car on our street, I saw Ashley sitting on her front steps. She looked at me walking towards our house and mouthed the word, "liar." The humiliation was almost too much to bear. But really, I was a liar. It's ironic. Lying was all I had done since I'd arrived on Earth. My name, where I was from, where my father was, why I couldn't stay the night at another girl's house. Lying was all I knew, and it was what kept me alive. But when Ashley called me a liar, the one time I was telling someone the truth, I was unspeakably angry. I stormed up to my room, slammed the door, and punched the wall. To my surprise, my fist went straight through. Katerina slammed my door open, wielding a kitchen knife and ready to strike. She thought the noise she'd heard must be Moogs. When she saw what I had done to the wall, she realized that something had changed with me. She lowered the blade and smiled. "Today is not the day you get on a plane, but it is the day you're going to start your training." 7 years later, sitting on this plane with Marina and Ella, I hear Katerina's voice in my head. "We'd be trapped up there." But I'm ready for that possibility now, in ways that Katerina and I weren't before. I've since flown dozens of times, and everything has gone fine. However, this is the first time I've done it without using my invisibility legacy to sneak on board. I know I'm much stronger now, and I'm getting stronger by the day. If a couple of Moog soldiers charged at me from the front of the plane, They wouldn't be dealing with a meek young girl. I know what I'm capable of. I am a soldier now. A warrior. I am someone to fear, not hunt.